From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in the 1970s when the Fair Election Practices Campaign began a mission of bringing civil, issues-oriented campaigns to American politics. And thank goodness, because in the ensuing four decades, we haven't seen any negative ads or dirty politics. I kid, of course, but the Fair Elections Practices Campaign pushes on with an important mission and just launched their 2015 campaign last week here in Monroe County. This hour, we want to talk about a number of related issues. Does the campaign work? And what about negative ads? Do they work? What does the research say? We want to hear from you, the voters. You can join the conversation about what you expect from your political campaigns. Let me welcome my guests for the hour. Sheila Abling's here. She is the vice president of the League of Women Voters Rochester Metro Area and working on this campaign as well. Sheila, it's great to have you. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Evan. Thank you for having me.
And Neil Jasek is here with the Interfaith Alliance of Rochester, and also someone who's worked on a number of good government issues over the years. No surprise to see you working on this one, Neil. Nice to have you.
Well, thank you, Evan. It's good to be here, too.
Before we talk about what fair elections really are, we want to briefly let our listeners know that there has been some interesting developments, I think, to say the least, in the photonics, the question of where the photonics headquarters is going to go. You might have heard that last night a statement came from SUNY Polytechnic, which is helping oversee the project, along with the, quote, Rochester Business Leaders Photonics Working Group, announcing that they selected Legacy Tower for the home of the headquarters for photonics. And then came some swift denials, including from Assembly Majority Leader Joe Morelli, who says that SUNY Polytechnic is getting way ahead of themselves. And just a little bit ago this morning, he talked to my colleague Beth Adams. We want to play that conversation for you now so you can hear the very latest on what's going on with photonics.
Well, let me start by asking, did the statement released last night by SUNY Polytech and the local work group take you by surprise?
Well, first of all, the local work group is a handful of business leaders, I think three or four, and I think, respectfully, they've never met even as a work group. I think they have been manipulated by the leader of SUNY Poly in Albany, who seems to want to reach in and tell the Rochester community where we will site photonics facilities in Rochester, which is strange to me. Last time I checked, SUNY Poly is a state institution. State money is appropriated by the state legislature. And frankly, I resent the decision to try to breach into Rochester and tell us where they will site facilities. This is a collaboration. The University of Rochester has equal standing in the organization with SUNY Poly. RIT is a member, it said, of a broad consortium. But more importantly, the Finger Lakes Regional Economic Development Council, appointed by the governor, and we work very closely with the governor, has been working on our upstate revitalization plan. Photonics is a central element in that plan. We have had broad discussions with a large group of business and community leaders over the last several months. We've had public hearings. We've had transparency. We're the ones collectively who will make the decision about where facilities in Rochester are located and what's the best use of facilities in Rochester. And while a number of us have expressed interest in the Sibley Building because it's part of the Rochester Innovation Zone, it is where High Tech of Rochester is co-located. It's where RIT Center for Urban Entrepreneurship is located. It's where Startup New York is located. Despite that, and despite our preferences, we were perfectly happy to enter into a transparent process, and a number of different landlords and buildings could make a pitch. This rushed to judgment by SUNY Poly out of Albany to tell us what is happening is just simply unacceptable, and I intend to inquire, obviously, of a state university as to how they would try to intervene in such a way.
So if I'm understanding you correctly, Joe, you're saying this was more than just a lack of communication. It's an indication of an apparent struggle for control of the project. Am I overstating that?
No, I think, sadly, I think that has become clear to us. I think those of us in Rochester thought we were in partnership here and continued to act in good faith, and I've continued to communicate with the governor's senior staff and the governor. I work with them, as you can imagine, on a daily basis. And this is a cooperative effort between the state, the federal government, private partners, the Finger Lakes Regional Economic Development Council, and which I hesitate to point out was established by the governor. to do this very thing that we are trying to do, which is to determine what best suits the Rochester economy and what could be transformational. So to have the president of an Albany-based SUNY campus come in and try to dictate terms insist that he knows better than all the Rochester collective wisdom of the Rochester community, to me is somewhat startling. But we'll get it right. This is disappointing that it's turned into a public fight. We certainly didn't expect and anticipate this. SUNY Poly has had its way. The state of New York has invested billions in the work that they've done in Albany. And we haven't tried to intervene and make any arguments about what ought to happen in the Albany region. And I would respectfully hope that they're going to back away.
Are you concerned about what this kind of dissension could mean for the long-term future of this project? I mean, there are various numbers of groups, including SUNY Polytechnic, that have to work together to get this not only started up, but launched and running successfully.
Well, I'm not going to lie. This isn't the way we drew it up on the whiteboard. But I'm hopeful that people will come together. Look, this is an opportunity that we can't afford to miss. And I know that Congresswoman Slaughter, who's been the leader in this at the federal level, who I spoke with several times last night, and I think has expressed her concern about what has happened relative to SUNY Poly. But I believe they'll be persuaded that going it alone and trying to impose their will on the Rochester community and the Rochester business community without our participation, without the participation of elected leaders, is a bad strategy, and I'm optimistic they'll back away and agree to work collectively as they should in the coming months.
All right, that is Assembly Majority Leader Joe Morelli speaking to my colleague Beth Adams on Morning Edition this morning, getting you caught up to date on some of what has become a bit of a fractured approach to trying to figure out where the Photonics headquarters will go in downtown Rochester. So what began in a very united way is a little fractured now, but Mr. Morelli saying he thinks they will gear back a little bit and get everyone together. We'll keep you updated on that on WXXI News as developments unfold. All right, let's talk about what a fair campaign is. This hour we're focusing with a couple of folks who are involved in the 2015 edition of the Fair Election Practices Campaign. It just started a few days ago. And Sheila Abling is the vice president of the League of Women Voters of the Rochester metro area. And I want to ask Sheila, first of all, what it means by a fair election. What is the definition of what a fair election is?
Well, we're trying to encourage candidates for public office mm-hmm. to run positive, issue-based campaigns.
Simple as that.
Simple as that.
Does that mean if I'm running against Neil Jasek, I have to say nice things about Neil?
Not about him personally. We're sticking to the issues.
All right, as long as they're issues-based.
They're issues-based.
All right, Neil, what's your definition of a fair campaign?
Well, obviously, there's a lot of aspects to a fair election, but with respect to a fair campaign, we're focusing on sticking to the facts, staying away from personal or ad hominem kinds of arguments, and addressing the issues in terms of how one candidate or the other takes a position with respect to whichever issue is on the table, such as the location of the photonics.
Yes, yes, that's right. Boy, nobody can get along these days. Now, the question that I want to explore in a little bit of detail, if we could, throughout this hour that some of our listeners have already had this morning is how you adjudicate. Neil, you just used a word that some might actually find somewhat amorphous, which is facts, sticking to the facts and what version of the facts, et cetera. And I want to know how you adjudicate. So, Sheila, why don't you describe the process for me, assuming that candidates sign the pledge. I mean, they've got to do that. And the expectation, I think, from voters by now is that they will, right?
Yes. We have, as a matter of fact, since August 12th, we've had quite a few candidates sign the pledge. They have sent it in. And we have up through September 8th that they can do this. And then on September 8th, we will have the signing ceremony press conference at noon at downtown at the atrium Monroe County Office Building. And at that point, the candidates can come for picture ops or just come for the first time to sign. And so we hopefully will have quite a list of candidates at that point. Right now, as I said, we have quite a few already. And after the signing is finished, then we watch this campaign go. And if we see, or if the candidates see someone who is running a negative campaign, they can file a complaint with the hearing panel. And we have a hearing panel of people who have volunteered to, who in the past, when we can talk a little bit more about who they are and what they do, but the gist of it is they listen to the complaints, they deliberate, and then a decision is made. And the decision is made hopefully through consensus. It is really pushed to have a unanimous decision amongst the panel. And then it is given out to the media that very same day.
Okay. And to be clear to our listeners, just because someone signs a pledge doesn't mean that if your panel decides an ad is out of bounds, that the ad has to be taken off there. That's still up to the campaign generally, isn't it?
Well, you hope that they will be conscientious enough, to take it off.
And to say, I signed the pledge, and I'm going to follow the rules.
Right. Because one of the points of the pledge, which I would love to read to you,
I would love to hear the pledge. Our listeners are voters, and they should hear this.
Okay.
Go ahead.
So as a candidate for public office in the 2015 election, I pledge the following. I will conduct my campaign accurately and honestly. I will discuss the issues and participate in fair public debate with respect to my views and qualifications. I will not engage in, permit, or condone personal attacks upon the character of my opponents, nor will I engage in invasions of personal privacy unrelated to campaign issues. I will approve all materials concerning my campaign. I will not use or permit the use of any campaign material or advertisement which uses quotations or images taken out of context and to misrepresent the other candidate or other candidate's message. I will refuse to disseminate any campaign material or message in which I am not prominently identified. I will publicly repudiate any individual or group whose activities on my campaign's behalf, directly or indirectly, violate this fair campaign pledge.
Can you read that one again one more time? Because that one is important for anybody who's ever gotten a mailer that says, so-and-so candidate for the state Senate hates children and would imprison women, then their opponent says, that's not my mailer. It must be a group that supports me, but I don't have anything to do with it. Can you read that plank again?
I will publicly repudiate any individual or group whose activities on my campaign's behalf, directly or indirectly, violate this fair campaign pledge.
Okay. Any other planks? Is that it?
That's it. Six points.
Okay.
Yep.
So there's a number of questions that come from this here. And a lot of this is subjective. You know, Neil Jasek, when there's a plank that says, you know, I'm going to stay away from personal issues that are unrelated to the campaign, I will give you an example of a personal issue that became a question over whether it's relevant. This goes back years now. I won't mention names. Well, you know what? This was very, very public. This was a member of Congress who was running for re-election. And I recall I was one of the first reporters to have been mailed an envelope with divorce records, which are supposed to be sealed in New York State. Somebody had gotten a hold of them, sent them to us. And in the divorce filing, which goes back, in this case, I think it went back 15, 20 years, it was alleged that the member of Congress, who had obviously been married at the time, pulled a gun on his wife at a dinner party and threatened her in front of friends. There was never a police report, nothing like that. But the person who sent it to me said, you don't have to know where this is coming from, but I think this is relevant because this goes to character, and character matters in politics. Therefore, it is a relevant issue to a campaign. we ultimately decided that we were not going to do a story on it. Now, just about every other media outlet in town did. So it became, that's why I'm talking about it today. And some of our listeners might recall some of that, even though it was a number of years ago. But the subjective question was, is that just a personal issue or is that relevant? And aren't these subjective questions, Neil?
They are subjective questions, and you're forcing me to give a subjective answer.
Well, I know. So I guess the broader question, personal issues are personal and should not be related at all.
I agree, and there's a reason why divorce records are supposed to be sealed.
Mm-hmm.
So on that basis, I would say that it crossed the line. But the fact that someone is acting erratically and dangerously and whatever is not necessarily irrelevant to a person's character, as who's the famous congressman who had his girlfriend's, or he jumped into the tidal basin pool with a bunch of, I mean, that does go to character. Now, how much character influences you in terms of the individual's qualifications for what they are standing for office for, in terms of how well they can reason and legislate and represent the people they're supposed to represent, is another issue. For some people, that trumps everything. For others, they could care less. But it is true that that is an issue for many people.
And I only ask because I think our listeners will wonder if some of the planks are just easily sort of circumvented by a candidate who will claim that, well, that is relevant, or, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, you know, people that go to extreme, go to a lot of effort to try to dig up mud on someone.
Yeah. And they all seem to go to a lot of effort.
And they certainly
do
that. They're dealing with issues that cannot necessarily be proven. They're all allegations. I think in those circumstances, that's definitely in violation of the pledge. If there is a factual thing about an individual that is relevant, a court record or a conviction or something of that nature that has not been sealed, then that might be fair game. But I think it's very contextual. You can't really say yes or no blanketly on that.
I think it's an interesting point from Neil, because for our listeners who might remember that member of Congress's ex-wife said, look, we're way past this. We don't want this dredged up. I'm not angry. We get along just fine. So I think in many ways, my guess is, yes, that the fair campaign's, the current panels would probably deem that to be out of bounds. But it is subjective. And when it comes to the outside groups, Sheila Aibling, that's a big plank. That last one to me, I can't tell you how often I saw mail from both sides in a recent state Senate race that was remarkably ugly. I mean, they just want you to think that each candidate hates, you know, children or seniors or women. And everyone says, well, that's not me. Don't blame me. And that feels like a dodge, a big time dodge. How often are you and the panels dealing with those kinds of problems?
Well, I think with this past year, and that's what you're referring
yes.
to, there wasn't a lot of that going on. It was really centered on a particular race that you're referring to.
Yeah.
Okay. but for the most part, that was it. And we have a problem. We have these third party groups that are out there, these big PAC groups who are taking care of things their way, which is negative campaigning. But I really think that the candidates need to step up and remember that sixth point on the pledge.
I tend to think the sixth point on your pledge might be the most important because of the way our campaigns are funded these days. Do
mm-hmm.
you?
Mm-hmm. I don't disagree.
No question about it.
Yeah, definitely.
Why do you say that, Neil?
Well, because of the way that money is flooding into campaigning mm-hmm. nowadays, much of it through third parties or PACs that allegedly are supposed to have no contact with the candidate.
And no coordination, right.
No coordination.
Right.
So therefore, what they do is indeed independent of the candidate's decision-making, or we are to assume that. So the only recourse is for the candidate to repudiate it, and that's their responsibility.
But how often do they actually do it? That's what I want to know.
They, you know what? Honestly, in the past, they have done that, and they have done that. This past year, as I say, was a very unique situation. We did do some going out there and talking with some people, trying to find out, you know, why things were the way they were, and. You know, I heard words like risk. It's a risk to file a complaint. What if we don't win it? Kind of thing. Although I think when you do file a complaint, if you look back over the years with complaints that have been filed, for the most part, most of those have been won.
Sort of validated. Yeah.
They have been validated. So it's a problem, but we're pursuing it.
My concern is that, as Neil says, a candidate is not supposed to be coordinating with these big outside money groups, with
right.
PACs, with super PACs, et cetera. But a candidate, you know, could wink, wink, say, look, you guys do what you're going to do, hit my opponent the way you want to. I don't have to know about it. I'll come out and repudiate it. So we get the double benefit of this candidate, my opponent, being smeared. And then me looking like the bigger person for repudiating, and the game sort of snowballs. Is that a legitimate concern?
Of course it is.
It's a concern, but, I see no way to stop
but
it.
But you can't, yeah.
It's the current system.
It is the system, and we're hoping to pursue and try to get these people to have some conscience. You know, seriously, it's all about having a conscience, because once you're elected, those voters, mm-hmm. they're your constituents.
Yeah, I mean, there are many problems with campaigning, and you're touching the most serious
right.
one now.
Right.
The Fair Campaign Pledge cannot by itself solve these more serious problems, which is basically the influence of money in politics and the ability of third-party organizations to act independently.
Absolutely.
Until
yeah.
we deal with
yeah.
that issue,
mm-hmm.
the
mm-hmm.
pledge is really very, it can't really be effective against that kind of a crush. But it can be effective in terms of the behavior we expect from the candidate.
Absolutely. I think Neil's point's a great mm-hmm. one. This is a pledge that is designed to work within the current system. It's not
exactly.
a panacea.
Exactly.
And the League of Women Voters, for example, over the years have targeted a number of issues that they think are ripe for reform.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure that will continue to happen. Let's get a short break, and then I've got a number of interesting things when we come back. First of all, Reason TV put together a political ad from when Thomas Jefferson was running against John Adams, and they used the candidate's own words. So for those who think negative campaigning is an entirely new phenomenon, you will hear an interesting ad with Jefferson and Adams in their own words. We're going to have that coming up. And we're going to talk a little bit more about whether negative campaigning works, what some of the research that I've been able to dig up says, what Neil and Sheila would say about that. And get a little bit more of your feedback. I've been seeing some of your feedback, some questions about how the panel adjudicates, whether it would be partisan or not. I know you've heard those questions before, so we'll talk more about how the panel works as well. It's a conversation about the Fair Election Practices Campaign, which just began on August 12th. And on September 8th, they've got an official sort of a signing ceremony for all the candidates locally who are signing the pledge to try to campaign on the issues and campaign fairly. Talk more and get more of your questions and comments next on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, what can we learn about biodiversity if we reduced the world to just one cubic foot? A photographer has traveled the world answering that question, and he brings his one cubic foot frame to the Genesee River in Rochester. We'll meet him and find out what they're learning, what they'd like to see about our own biodiversity in the river. That's next hour.
The pangolin looks like a small armored anteater. Primarily found in Africa and Asia, it's now facing extinction.
They are finding crates filled with pangolin scales, you know, entire boats with bags of live or frozen and dead pangolins that are being taken from the wild.
Pangolins in peril. Later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on WXXI.
Welcome back to Connections. My guest for the hour, as we talk about the Fair Election Practices campaign that just kicked off for 2015, Sheila Aibling is the vice president of the League of Women Voters in the Rochester metro area, and Neil Jasek with the Interfaith Alliance of Rochester. They are working on the 2015 edition of the Fair Election Practices campaign. You heard Sheila reading the various planks of the pledge that the candidates have to sign if they want to be part of the Fair Elections Practices campaign. And certainly there is, I think there is a problem for candidates who won't sign the pledge now. So it has gained a lot of currency with voters. But certainly we should also point out that negative campaigning is not necessarily a super modern phenomenon. In fact, Reason Magazine and Reason TV put together their own ads using the actual words of Adams and Jefferson. So let's listen to these ads as put together by Reason TV.
John Adams is a blind, bald, crippled, toothless man who wants to start a war with France. While he's not busy importing mistresses from Europe, he's trying to marry one of his sons to a daughter of King George. Haven't we had enough monarchy in America?
I'm Thomas Jefferson, and I approve this message because John Adams is a hideous, hermaphroditical character with neither the force and firmness of a man nor the gentleness and sensibility of a woman.
If Thomas Jefferson wins, murder, robbery, rape, adultery, and incest will be openly taught and practiced. The air will be rent with the cries of the distressed. The soil will be soaked with blood and the nation black with crimes. Are you prepared to see your dwellings in flames, female chastity violated, children writhing on a pike?
I'm John Adams, and I approve this message because Jefferson is the son of a half-breed Indian squaw raised on hoe cakes, and Hamilton is a Creole bastard brat of a Scotch peddler.
That's Reason TV using the actual words that were written at the time. All right, Neil and Sheila, I have to think that the Fair Election Practices campaign would rule those ads out of bounds.
Well, I would certainly hope so. Yes, yes, absolutely. Neil, no doubt.
Historically, what do you make of that?
We do know that there were no punches pulled in the early days and the middle days and the current time of this republic. There are good examples of painting people through innuendo, unprovable facts, negative adjectives all over the map that influence the way you feel about someone. And that's the kind of thing that really should have no business in campaigning.
Well, it does go back to the beginning of our country, but I think it's a noble effort to see what the Fair Election Practices campaign is doing to try to curb it. The question is, are you curbing it because negative campaigns work, attack ads work? I want to ask Sheila and Neil if you think that sort of attack ads, negative ads, does it work, Sheila?
Well, it draws attention to the candidates, and I think that's probably where they're coming from, okay? But I guess I go back to the voters. You know, what are the voters learning about the candidate as their representative who will be elected? And I think ultimately we have to be thinking about the voter. And that's really what it's about. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of what I'm thinking of at this point.
Neil, do they work?
They certainly do in some cases and they don't in others. A lot of it depends upon timing. When you are the victim of a negative ad, you have a very difficult choice. How do you respond to it? And many people feel that, you know, you don't get into a spitting contest with a skunk, that the best thing to do is to ignore it. But I think, as John Kerry found out too late, that's not really the way you deal with those kinds of things. You have to hit them head on. So if they happen early enough in a campaign where you can not reply in kind, but show how the negative advertising is just not based on anything, then there's a chance that it could be negated. But those negative ads that appear 24 hours before Election Day are the ones that you have to worry about the most.
And John Kerry essentially chose, and I don't want to oversimplify history, but there was a debate, I think, internally in his campaign about how much do I respond to the so-called swift voting or not. And he was somewhat passive about it, and a lot of his supporters felt it cost him. And so here are some of our comments just on Twitter in the last hour from our listeners talking about this. Nicholas says, negative campaigning gets people who like the other guy not to vote. It's fine in a zero-sum game. Here's another comment. They worked against John Kerry. Matt says, they do work. Ask John Kerry about swift vote veterans. Mike says, campaigns are so meticulously data-driven now that I doubt they would use negative ads if they didn't work. They must work. Well, a comprehensive literature analysis published in 2007 in the Journal of Politics examined the effects of political ads, and the authors reported that negative ads tended to be more memorable than positive ones. So number one, they're more memorable. The 3 a.m. ad, a Pac-Man ad, you can think of a number of ads, Swift Boats, etc. But the authors also found they did not necessarily affect voter choice. People were no less likely to turn out to the polls or to decide against voting for a candidate who was attacked in an ad. But there was a difference in what voters said based on when the ads were run, exactly Neil's point. Yeah. So what the FAIR campaigns, what this practice is about is sort of policing an issue that does have an impact, that can, not every time. But it can, is what we're finding historically. So I want to get some of your phone calls. If you want to call the program, it's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. This is Keith in Farmington. Go ahead, Keith.
I got a couple comments, but I have two questions. What type of ad would this be? Let's say if I'm running for office and I said, my opponent does not like puppies as much as I do. And next time you see my opponent, ask him if he has stopped beating his wife. Now, I don't really come out saying anything. I'm just implying that. And the other question I have is, or maybe a statement, you guys are fighting a losing battle. Maybe on a local level, you might have some influence. But on the national level or a statewide level, until you get the power of money out of there, and I'm a firm believer that all the candidates should have all the same money so they can spend it the way they want. If somebody wants to go attack it, so be it. If somebody wants to go issues, let them go issues. But it's never, ever going to happen because of outside money.
Well, I think the money is definitely a big, big problem. I don't disagree with you on that, but I guess I really feel very strongly that we just can't throw up our hands and say, oh, well, what are we going to do?
Oh, I agree. And the fact is that there are efforts at work to try to clean up the money issue. There are severe limitations that have been put on us by the Supreme Court, but that doesn't mean it's not impossible. And people have been working quite hard and diligently, and at some point you have to have some faith that the system will work and allow it to succeed.
We have to pursue it.
Keith is also raising the question on if he runs an ad that says, next time you see my opponent, ask him if he stopped beating his wife. And he's wondering, you know, that's a television ad. What are the various forms that you would police? Obviously, that's the kind of ad that your panel would say that's out of bounds. That's a television ad. What are the various forms that you would sort of monitor and potentially adjudicate?
Well, all of the mailers, everything.
Anything.
Mailers, print ads. Sure. Yeah. One of the more difficult ones that's popped up, of course, is social media.
Mm-hmm.
But and we don't really know how to
Can the panel adjudicate a tweet or a comment that is made, on Facebook or Twitter?
This year, I believe we're going to get right into that. That sort of thing. We've tried to do some advertising, I know, on Facebook. You know, we're doing a lot of that. So that is something that we will watch and see this year.
It's very, very difficult because the question is, do tweets and Facebook posts, are they private conversation or are they public statements? And that's
See, I look at it as public myself.
Yeah,
you put it out there.
It is public. Anybody can look at it.
Yeah.
And so in other words, Sheila, because they're making a public statement to public followers.
I think that would be.
Could I ask another question?
Yes, Keith, go ahead.
What about if I'm a politician and I say something like, I'm way smarter than my opponent, or in other words, I don't attack my opponent, but I just say how much greater I am. I mean, how are you going to prove that somebody's smarter? I don't say my opponent is a dumb moron. I can say I'm better looking than my opponent. I'm more attractive. I'm smarter. I the only thing that, you know, unless you can prove it, like I'm older than my opponent, so therefore I'm smarter. It just opens up a whole can of worms that might be hard to adjudicate as to who's correct and who's wrong. I think it's very sad that elections have come to this, but the other problem we have, and I'm sure your panelists will agree, is you have an incredibly stupid population that will almost believe anything that their opponent says about, or excuse me, their candidate says about their opponent without actually looking for the facts. And the biggest issue of that is, for, and you can see it, I have friends that repost stuff on Facebook that is so far out in left field, all you got to do is go to some urban legend site or Snoop, and then you post saying, hey, you know, this isn't true. But because it's on the internet, we know it has to be the truth.
It must be the truth. Yeah, Keith, I appreciate that. I'm not sure Sheila and Neil would endorse the idea that the population is voting population is stupid collectively, but I do take the point that there are missed opportunities for civic education, and that's part of what they're doing here. And Sheila and Neil, before I go to our next caller, just a brief comment on Keith's point that if you run an ad saying I'm much smarter than my opponent, I don't know if you can touch that, unfortunately.
You're boasting about yourself. That's all part of the campaigning that you're doing. I don't see it as
I think you just have to hope that the voters are intelligent.
Yeah, they'll have to discern the voters themselves as to.
Tim in Pittsburgh, you're next, Tim. Go ahead.
I hate to agree with what Keith just said, but I don't disagree that you're giving the voters way too much credit. I include myself in that stupid category. I honestly do. But I have a job where I'm able to listen to the radio all day, and I torment myself by listening to politics all day. But you have normal people like my wife go to work 9 to 5. She's not able to listen to the radio except for maybe the half hour on the way home when she's got three screaming kids in the car. And the only thing that she's seeing at night are just little snippets of commercials, which are the negative attack ads. So she basically has to be – you're asking people to be smart enough to pick things out of there that are either good or not good. And that's where, you know, to me, I'm afforded – I'm listening to the radio all the time. I can go back and forth and figure things out, but – you're asking the majority of people out there to really do a lot of research into this. And what are they going to do? Are they going to go online where the first things that are trending are not five political stories? They're what someone was – they may be what a politician was wearing at the last debate instead any of their views on anything. So I honestly do think we're giving people a lot more credit than maybe not that they deserve, but that the information that they're given is not what – we would like them to hear. So these attack ads, if you can get one point across that someone might say, oh, maybe they're right about this, they may not see, they may not hear anything about that candidate for another, who knows how long, for the rest of the election if they don't listen to the radio or watch TV or life is just going on. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the negative ads do work. They run them for a reason, and they run them a lot for a reason. I hate to say it, but they do work, and I don't think they're going anywhere.
Well, we're going to keep trying. I'll tell you.
Well, you raise another question, another point, which is that to try to discern the value of a candidate from a 30-second, 60-second even a 2-minute spot is close to impossible. You only have enough time to either make a charge against your opponent or talk about what a good, loving person you are and how good you're going to do. And that's one of the problems with political advertising. I think one of the things that XXI and others should do is require a candidate to come in and give them at least 15 to minutes to a half an hour to go over some things and respond to a back and forth and questions. Only in that kind of a setting will you get a sense of how the person thinks and where they might come down on the issues that you're concerned about.
Yeah. I don't disagree, and that's why we have invited the candidates for various offices. In fact, yesterday we had the Green Party candidate for Monroe County Executive on this program. We've had Cheryl Donolfo, the Republican, and Sandy Frankel, the Democrat. They've both given us an hour already, and they're going to give us more time for the election. And it's great to have candidates sit down and speak at length, not just deliver something packaged in 30 seconds.
And that's what the responsible voter out there should be doing, should be listening to these kinds of speeches.
Stepping forward. Now for something a little different. David in Rochester is going to push back a little bit from what he's been hearing. Okay. Go ahead, David.
Yeah, I think I'm really getting a little tired of hearing people calling people stupid. I think the overwhelming amount of people are not stupid. It's what they're fed by the media. It's what they choose not to listen to. So there's a big difference between being uninformed, ignorant, and stupid. Most people simply are not stupid. I'll take the reaction off the air. Thank you.
David, thank you for that.
I agree with you 100%.
Yeah, absolutely.
Uninformed is correct for many, but stupid, I agree, is not.
Thank you for that, David, and it's a good reminder that, again, more civic education, more informed voters are important. And we've had a number of questions from our listeners this hour about how the panel works. Neil Jasek, first of all, let's go back a little bit in time. Was there always a panel sort of adjudicating whether campaigns were fair?
Back in the 60s, there was a panel that was convened by the League of Women Voters, called the Fair Election Practices Committee, that somewhere in the 70s was discouraged by one of the political parties who felt that the decisions reached and the activities of the League of Women Voters was, in their opinion, biased. And they then refused to participate, and the whole thing collapsed. And it stayed there for quite a while. In the 70s, when the Interfaith Alliance was first formed, its main emphasis was on civility in public conversation. And in conjunction with the League, we put together a pledge, somewhat different but similar to the one that Sheila read, that tried to get candidates to stick to the issues and conduct their campaigns in a civil way. And that went for about 2, 3, or 4 years without even a panel to adjudicate. One of the members of the League of Women Voters, Sally Brown, put together yeoman work in the mid-70s to bring together respected people from both parties who agreed to sit on a panel and call themselves the Fair Election Practices Committee that would actually then serve as adjudicators of complaints that people were violating the pledge. And that is how it has grown over time until now.
And then the question becomes for many of our listeners, are the panelists doing a fair job? Is it partisan, et cetera? How do you structure the panel? How does it work?
Well, the selection of the five members of the actual hearing panel, there are two members who are politically involved as Republicans and have been, actually, and two who are politically involved as Democrats. Now, to maintain balance on the committee, we do have a minimum of two alternates as well of each of the parties. And basically, the chairperson of the committee must possess a level of honesty and integrity and a lack of bias. And that's actually recognized in the community. You know, we have to keep in mind that as we look for them, all of these members as well should have a degree of fairness and sound judgment as well. Now, this year, we are also having what we call observers of the hearing panel. And they are the representatives of both the Democratic and the Republican Party who are attending each of the hearings. And they will not deliberate and they will not vote. They are literally going to be observers. So that is basically the setup of it. And they are selected by the Interfaith Alliance of Rochester and the League of Women Voters.
And I think I might just want to add to that is that I believe that literally every one of their decisions is unanimous.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And again, so you've got both parties represented there, both major parties, I should say. Jenna writes to us on Twitter, though, and says, why isn't a candidate's personal life relevant? Perhaps Eric Massa and Christopher Lee wouldn't have been elected at all. That cost taxpayers money. She's saying personal foibles impacted their ability to govern, and she would like those things considered.
Well, I think we agreed that character is an ingredient. The question is, you know, how well you are accurately describing that person's character flaws and how relevant those are to their ability to do their job. And there is no black and white answer to that.
That's a very subjective point.
Yeah, I agree.
Point.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with that.
Jenna, I think that's a hard one to answer. I agree with the panel on that, Jenna. But I do think I understand the sentiment. Watching Christopher Lee, Eric Massa, watching what happened, and then dealing with special elections and everything that is the cost to taxpayer, the instability of the seat, the lack of experience in office, we all wish we could avoid that. But unfortunately, now there's 535 members of the Senate and Congress, and I suspect there are personal foibles that haven't even yet come out that maybe will eventually. Jen writes to us on Twitter, I'll go with people are uninformed and unwilling to become informed because they might have to admit they were wrong. Well, that's interesting. That goes to the question of the echo chamber, that are you consuming media that only supports what you already believe? If you are a conservative, are you only listening to Limbaugh? If you are a liberal, are you only watching Rachel Maddow? And I think that that's unhealthy, and Jen's sort of saying some people don't want to experience other ideas. But the Fair Election Practices campaign does seek to be an issues-oriented campaign. So let me start to wrap the hour by asking the people involved this year, Sheila Abling, the Vice President of Women Voters of the Rochester Metro Area, and Neil Jasek from the Interfaith Alliance of Rochester. Sheila, what is your hope for the campaign this year? To have no complaints at all? I mean, is that always a goal? What's
your
goal?
No. Well, no. I am hoping, I'm going back to the premise of wanting our candidates in going for public office to conduct themselves in a fair, issue-oriented campaign. And focus on the issues. That's what the voters want to hear.
Okay. Neil?
And actually, yeah, I think as an absolute goal, it would be nice if we did have no complaints mm-hmm. over the course of the year because there was nothing to complain about. Mm-hmm. Sticking to the issues, running honest campaigns, and voters paying attention so that they get the facts that they need to have in order to cast an intelligent vote.
Because I've got 90 seconds. Oh, go ahead, Sheila.
Yeah, and I just wanted to throw in also, speaking of voters, as I've been talking about, it's my voter service piece coming through. Please be sure you're registered to vote. You have now until October to vote, to register for the November election. If you have not registered for the primary election, it is too late for that. But you can register still for the election in November, on November 3rd. And please, once you have registered, vote. Get out there. If you need a ride, call the League of Women Voters. We'll figure something out.
Sheila's not going to like hearing the host say this. I always say, if you haven't bothered to inform yourself, don't feel like you have to vote. But I'd rather you do bother to inform yourself.
Yeah.
I'd rather everyone who can register does, and everyone takes the time to do more than just read the mailers that come, that make for really, really interesting landfill filler or recycling center material. Don't just read those and inform yourself. But I always think, if you don't bother, that's all right. You know, I mean, there are those of us who are bothering, but Sheila's looking at me saying, let's vote. Let's
don't
get more
even
people
think about it, Evan.
Get out there and vote. I want to thank our guests for the hour, Sheila Aibling from the League of Women Voters, the Rochester metro area. Great having you. Good luck with the campaign this year. And I suspect there may be a complaint or two. We'll see how these things come out, and we'll be in touch again. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Evan.
And Neil Jasek with the Interfaith Alliance of Rochester, working on this campaign, always ambitious. Whenever I talk to Neil, I learn something, and I see someone who really has big ideas for what this state is capable of. Thank you, Neil. It's nice to talk to you.
Thank you, Evan.
Short break, and we're going to come back and talk about what you would find in 1 cubic foot of our local environment, and the answer might blow you away. We're going to talk to a man who's traveled the world doing that. He's in Rochester now. That's next.